Juliet Dogcast Radio. If you like dogs, wherever you are in the world, we're the show for you. Hello and welcome to episode 26 of Dogcast Radio. In this episode, we bring you a special where we focus on the wonderful work of guide dogs. You've probably seen them out and about guiding their owner, but how much do you know about the process that produces guide dogs? How young does a guide dog start work? How old do they stop work? What's it like to build a relationship with a dog that acts as your eyes? And how do you take the leap of faith required to place the necessary trust in your guide dog? Before that, 2-minute fiction, romance, written by Julie Hill, read by Kate and Nick Coldham.
I've heard it said that having a dog can help you meet your ideal partner. I thought it was all nonsense until it happened to me. It wasn't just my dog, it was also, well, it's not a nice subject to mention really. I'll tell you the whole story and then you can see for yourself. My dog is gorgeous. She's a collie cross, black and white, full of energy. She's called Daisy and she keeps me on my toes. I love taking her out for long walks and then curling up with her back at home. She puts her head in my lap and emits occasional ladylike snores while I read a book. I put a lot of effort into training her, and she's very well behaved. I want people who meet her to think what a wonderful dog she is, and with her big brown eyes, she's a great ambassador for the canine community. One thing I'm emphatic about, though, is clearing up after her when we're out. It's not the most attractive aspect of owning a dog, but it's a necessary evil. Before we go out, I always make sure I've got enough poop bags to pick up any messes she makes. It really infuriates me how many dog owners don't seem to bother, though. I'm always having to step over little poop pyramids, and even worse, guide Daisy around them. She seems to avoid them anyway, looking away as if to say, "How gross." If I see anyone letting their dog make a mess, and they seem about to walk away, I always go over and offer them a poop bag. Sometimes they're rude, but usually they're embarrassed, and they clear up the mess. Well, one day I was in my front room, which overlooks the street outside, and I saw a sight that enraged me. I'd been watching an episode of my favourite soap opera, and I was standing up to go into the back garden to check on Daisy. She'd been a bit quiet for some time, and I suspected she was doing something naughty, like digging or eating my favourite plant. I was distracted from my plan by the sight that confronted me. A man with a border collie was letting his dog foul the sidewalk right in front of my house. Without another thought, I strode to the front door, wrenched it open, and hurried towards the man. "What do you think you're doing?" I demanded. He turned to me, but kept glancing down at the dog. He hadn't even bothered to buy a proper lead. He had the poor thing on a piece of string. "Are you going to clean that mess up?" I pointed angrily at the mess. He was still regarding me in confusion. Even through my fury, I noticed that he was very good looking. What a pity he had no moral fibre. "Do you even have any poop bags with you?"
It's not my dog," he began quietly.
"That's no excuse," I cut across him. "It's disgusting, letting your dog do that right in front of my house. Whoever owns that dog, if you're going to walk him, you should clean up after him." I was in full flow now.
"Do you live here?"
he asked, looking at the number on my door. "Yes, and I don't intend to let you get away with letting your dog..." This time, I was interrupted.
"Actually..."
he said this with a smile.
"It's your dog."
"Now listen..." "Pardon?" I couldn't believe it. The cheek. My dog was playing in my garden. "My dog is playing in my garden," I informed him smugly. However, when I looked closely at the dog, it did look very like Daisy. I hadn't been looking at the dog. I'd been too busy glaring angrily at the handsome stranger. It didn't just look like Daisy. It was Daisy. My smugness evaporated. I don't understand," I murmured weakly.
I think she must have escaped from your garden. I found her on my doorstep. Your address is on her tag, so I was bringing her home. And I don't carry poop bags because I don't have a dog of my own."
It made sense now. "And you have her on a string lead because you don't own a proper one."
"Yes, absolutely right. Do you want to take her?"
He offered me the string handle. As I took it, our fingers brushed. And even in my embarrassment over my hideous mistake, it was lovely. "Thank you so much for bringing her back," I said, giving him a big smile. "I'll have to go and check the fence, see how she escaped."
"Do you want me to give you a hand?"
He really did have a very attractive smile. That would be very helpful, I said, as he followed me down the path to my front door. Do you know, he helped me fill in the hole by the fence that Daisy had dug to escape. He helped me check round the rest of the fencing, and he even took a poop bag and went and cleared up the mess Daisy had made. We've been on our first date. Well, we took Daisy for a walk in the park, but it was great. We're going to the cinema tonight, and I know it's incredibly early, but I really think he might be Mr. Right. Anyway, that's my story. That's how I met my ideal man. Well, at least I think he's my ideal man. And it was all down to my dog. Well, not exactly my dog, more my dog's. Well, it's really not nice to mention it, is it? See my difficulty? However will I tell the story to our children in a nice way? I suppose I really am getting ahead of myself there, but I'll have plenty of time to figure it out. It just shows that standing up for what you believe in has its own rewards.
You're listening to Dogcast Radio on www.dogcastradio.com. Our dogs enrich our lives in so many ways, but to some people, their dog is essential. Julie Rodaway's dog gives her independence, freedom, and confidence, because Julie is blind, and Wallace, a cream Labrador, is her guide dog. We went to meet Julie and Wallace and learned a lot about the marvellous work these dogs do, and about one gorgeous dog in particular.
How old is a guide dog when he comes to you, when you get paired with him?
Normally they can be anything from 18 months old. I think the latest is 20 months.
Mm.
My dogs have always been 18, 19 months old when I've had them.
Mm, amazing.
Yeah.
And what does that process consist of? Do you meet several dogs? Or?
No, what happens is there's a lot of misconceptions. People think, you know, you just apply for a guide dog and you just get given this dog out of thin air and off you go. You know, it isn't like that. What happens is you have to fill in quite an in-depth application form, and you have to provide the Guide Dog Association with quite a bit about yourself, about your height, your weight, your lifestyle, your interests and hobbies, whether you have some sight or no sight, whether you have any other additional impairments. So I have a slight hearing loss on the left hand side, so I had to tell them about that because that affects my balance. And what they'll do is they'll examine the form and they come out and do quite an in-depth interview with you, and they'll go into issues a bit more. I mean, they'll look at situations like where your dog's likely to sleep, where your dog's likely to spend, where the parks are, where, you know, the vet is in relation to your house.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll go into things like your lifestyle a bit more, what your interests are, how demanding a lifestyle socially you lead.
Mm-hmm.
Because they like to match the dog to the person. So, like, I'm quite quiet. And my dogs have always been likewise.
Mm.
Whereas I've got friends who are nutters, so their dogs are mad, you know.
Yes.
So they reflect their sort of lifestyle, you know. So it's quite an in-depth process. And then the next part of the assessment, you feel like an idiot, believe me. What the instructors do is you grab hold of one end of the harness and they pretend to be a dog on the other end, and they will take you out in the street and they will give you certain commands that you're likely to give a prospective guide dog, like no, leave it, forward, straight on, right, left, and you have to use certain foot positions and hand signals in conjunction with these commands to make it clearer to the dog what you're expecting of it. And they will assess while you're doing that and feeling like an idiot in the street talking to a non-existent dog, they will assess things like your posture, your walking speed, your stance. So they will be looking at you very carefully as you're doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And they will Also, no, they will then, after they've done that, they'll go away and they'll sort of write to you a few weeks later and say, yes, we recommend you for a dog, or no, we don't think you're suitable. Because it does happen that not everybody who applies for a dog will get a dog. That there are, you know, certain people who they think aren't suitable for a dog. Maybe they don't lead as active a lifestyle to merit a dog, or maybe there are other circumstances, you know, they don't feel people are ready for the responsibility, because it is a responsibility. And that they also spell this out to you quite clearly when they assess you. So, I mean, the whole start to finish from the first time I applied, I was 18 at the time, and it took a year from my original application, and I got my first dog at 19. So, and then what happened, if they accept you, then they will match a dog as near to your characteristics or as personality as they can get. And they will match the dog, will be happy, you know, with your lifestyle. And things like, also they consider if you've got additional pets, if you've got kids, if you've got a work routine, all this is taken into consideration when they... So it's certainly not, here's a dog, get on with it. I mean, it's a lot more involved than people realise from their point of view, and mine.
And then when the dog's, you know, so the 18, 20 months, and then they've said, yes, this is going to be your dog, presumably then you that's the start of building a partnership.
Oh, very much so. I mean, what used to happen in the early days before they changed the training procedure is you would be called to a residential training centre for a 3 or 4 week very intensive training course, which would be residentially based, and you would know nothing about your dog. You wouldn't know the dog's name, you wouldn't know anything about... All you knew is that you had a dog. And the very first time you met the dog is when you went to train. But now what they do, and what they did with Wallace here, is they told me a lot about him and gave me a good idea of his characteristics, and you have the choice then as to whether you want to do what they call a matching visit, which is where they bring the dog out to you and you do quite a long walk with the dog, where you will put the dog through its paces, you will walk with the dog, and the instructor will see how you look together, how you gel together, and you know, they'll say, yes, we definitely think this dog is right for you, or oh no, sorry, we thought it was right, but it's not quite right. But in his case, as soon as I walked with him, I thought, yeah, he feels it, feels right, it, you know, he walks at my pace, he's a lovely lad. So after a matching visit, what they do then is they finish the training off for another 6 weeks after the initial matching visit, put any final sort of touches to the training, anything that you say you need work-wise. Like, I mean, I have to go through a busy town centre, so, you know, I asked for him to be shown certain routes, and, you know, I asked to be, you know, sort of done... the instructors to do train work with him, buses and stuff, and I asked them to do that before I got him. So you can sort of fine tune, you know, with the instructors what you think you need, and then I had Wallace for a week for him to settle in, where he did no work at all, but it was just a settling in period for him and for me, so that we got to know each other really. And during that time, it really tested my patience, because what the instructors always say to you is, you give them an inch and they'll take a mile. They're like kids, you know, they rebel. And he tested my patience in so much as he was very attached to his trainer. And as far as they're concerned, it must be bewildering, because what happens with them is when they're 6 weeks old, they get picked up, that's I think the term they use, and given to their puppy walkers, who will introduce them to very basic obedience, get them used to shops, trains, buses, any sort of situation, you know, that they're likely to come across in the working life. And they're with those people till they're 12 months old. Then they're placed with instructors who start introducing harness work, and they're with those instructors till more or less we get them. So from his point of view, he was obviously bewildered. Who's this crazy woman I'm with, you know? Well, how am I here? Why am I here, you know? So he didn't know me, so he defied me. He tested me, he really did. Oh, you're not my boss, you're not alpha, you know, who are you, you know? So I had to be quite firm but gentle, but I had to let him know right from the upset that I was taking over, I was boss, you know? So the week of him being here without him working, it was he really did test my patience. He really did. He did defy me quite a bit. But those are teething problems, because the dogs don't understand. I mean, he doesn't understand that he's going to be with me for the rest of his life. You know. And also because he's used to going out every day, he's used to working every day. He got quite restless and bored being in for a week. You know. But those are teething problems, and then the training began, you know, a week later. Started working with the instructor a week later.
And is that sort of one-to-one with the instructor?
Yeah, one-to-one, yeah. I trained from home, which was great for me, because when I trained residentially, I was using routes that I'd never ever use again.
Yes.
But with training from home, I was using routes that I would use, you know, walking wise every day, so I knew where I was going. Which suited me right down to the ground, you know, so I could help Wallace familiarise himself with these routes, you know, with the instructor helping him, you know, if I made mistakes, or if he wasn't sure, you know, and he was a bit, needed reassurance, you know, from a visual point of view, which I can't give him at all.
No.
So, you know, the instructor was there to sort of help us through that initial period, and that one-to-one home training, she was with me for 3 or 4 weeks. And then they leave you to it for about 6 or 8 weeks on your own. But you have to send in weekly reports to let them know how things are going, whether you're having any teething problems. And if not, fine, they leave you to it. And if you are, they're very supportive, and they'll come out and help you through. After which, you send in a report once a month for the following 12 months, and then you're on your own unless you have any problems, or they come out twice a year to do a routine aftercare visit just to make sure you and the dog are safe.
I had no idea it was such a long...
Oh, it's quite a long intensive... And, you know, like I couldn't work my friend's guide dog, or they couldn't work mine, or, you know, each dog is sort of trained with the, you know, in specific individual in mind. It's you don't just give them a dog and off you go. It's a lot more involved than people realise.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing that occurs to me is sort of when I think of Buddy at 18 months, I would not have trusted him with, you know, basically my life, and sort of said, okay, off you go, mate, lead me. But obviously these dogs have been through, you know, as you said, from real babyhood, from puppyhood, they've been exposed to lots of situations, and it's a very different dog that you're dealing with. But even so, it must be a huge leap of faith to put your trust in that dog.
Oh, it's hard. I mean, it really... I mean, when I went for my first guide dog, it was the first time I'd ever walked with a guide dog, and, you know, my first guide dog, she only had one speed, and that was a rocket, you know, everything was quick, you know, she hated walking slow, hated it, and she would walk at some speed, believe me, and you're walking along and you think, what, she doesn't stop at the curb, or what if I bump into a lamppost or a ladder, or you think, oh my goodness, you know, what if she doesn't stop? And I used to be petrified, especially like during the training, because I think, my God, what if she doesn't stop and I trip over a curb? And of course she always did.
Yeah.
But it takes a while to sort of realise that, hey, your guide dog is going to stop at the curb, or it is going to guide me around a ladder or a scaffolding or people on the pavement, you won't get out of the way, you know. But that trust does take a while to develop, you know, it does. And one of the exercises they do is they take you to a railway station. They get you to go to the edge of the platform, and my first dog, with my first dog, they did this, and they told me I was on the edge of the platform, and the instructor said, okay, I want you to tell your dog to go forward. I thought, no way, no way, I don't want to die, no way, no, no chance, you know. And I just froze, I just couldn't do it, I just couldn't do it. And the instructor said, come on, just tell your dog. F-O-R, meaning forward, you know, just tell her to go. And I went forward, you know, rather timidly, and of course the dog just wouldn't budge. So that was to illustrate to me that the dog knew it was on the edge of the platform, knew I was on the edge of the platform, and had been trained in that instance to defy me and not go forward. There are certain situations where the dog will defy you, and sort of use its judgment instead of yours. But 99% of the time, it is a two-way partnership. You take the leading role, and the dog does the guiding work, and you make all the decisions. Sometimes you're wrong. Sometimes, for instance, he could stop in the middle of the pavement, and I might think he's sussing how to guide me round an obstacle, and I don't realise he's stopping to have a look at something he can scavenge, and I'm encouraging him, good lad, you know, and he's looking at the floor, you know, seeing what he can. Sometimes you do make mistakes because you don't know.
No.
You know, you have to give the dog the benefit of the doubt. Sometimes he could be sussing out a situation, and equally, I may think he's messing me about, and I may tell him off. But he's doing right. But then again, you know, they're very forgiving, and they will, you know, realise that, hey, you know, you're not infallible, you know. But they're easy dogs to handle, and you know, because of the training and everything, you know. But it does take a long time to trust your dog. It really, especially with a new dog. Because although they're guiding, they feel different in harness to your other one, and they do things differently, and they may guide you in a slightly different way, you know. It does take time.
It's a very, I mean, every dog is an individual, and it does strike me that it's a very complicated, as you said, sort of a complex relationship, because, I mean, one of the things they say with an ordinary dog is, you know, you stay in front. You know, you make sure the dog stays to your heel. You're the alpha. And there's lots of, you know, signals to the dog. As you've said, you know, you need to be the alpha in the pack. Whereas with a guide dog, there's well, it seems to me as an outsider, you know, there's many ways in which you're saying to the dog, you're in charge in this situation. You know, it's confusing for the dog, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, yeah. I mean, there are certain situations where I have to give him his head. Because I can't help him. You know, I can direct him, but I can't help him. Situations where, for instance, I might be halfway across the road, and you know some cars are very quiet.
Yeah.
And I do have a hearing loss anyway, mm-hmm. so I can't sometimes hear cars unless mm-hmm. they're literally, you know, by me, you know, mm-hmm. yards in front of me, and then I hear them.
Mm-hmm.
So at which point you're halfway across the road.
Mm-hmm.
So what he will do is he will take charge of the situation. He will just sit down, and then I have to gently urge him. I have to sort of gently move my hand in front of me as he's, and I have to say, "Up, up, good boy, up, up, good boy." And I know that he will move only when that car is gone.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to give him his head, you know, to trust him to do that. So in that sort of situation, although I'm helping him and directing him and urging him, he is in control, you know, in mm-hmm. that sort of situation. So yes, other situations I can't help him. If it's very crowded in a shopping centre, there are a lot of guide dog owners who have got some useful vision, so they can help the dog a bit, you know. Mm-hmm. Whereas I can't help him at all.
Mm-hmm.
So all I can do is let him have his head, let him weave me in and out of the people, let him weave me in and out of the crowd. And if I'm walking straight and he suddenly weaves me to the left, or he suddenly weaves me to the right, or he cuts across me for any reason, I have to learn to follow him. It's a bit like learning to tune into a radio station. You have to, you know, tune in to his movements
mm-hmm.
when he's working. So I have to sort of react
mm-hmm.
quickly as mm-hmm. he's working. So in those situations, he is totally in control of that situation as well. So yes, it's although in the main, you know, I am Alpha One and he knows I'm Alpha One, there are all times when he'll override my decision. If I think it's safe to go across the road and it isn't,
he
will override my decision and refuse to go until it is clear. But initially, it's I who will decide when I think it's safe to cross the road and not the dog.
Yeah.
But there are times when he'll override it, you know.
Yeah. He does a wonderful job, doesn't he?
Oh yeah, he's a good lad. Mm. He is a good lad. I mean, he's not infallible. He will make mistakes.
Mm.
You know, people think these dogs are superhuman and they never put a paw wrong. But they do. Believe me, they do. And he does, you know. I mean, if he sees something touching on the floor, or he sees another dog that he thinks he likes to say hello to,
yes.
he'll work, but his tail's wagging. I know he's distracted because his tail's wagging more than normal, so I know he's seen another dog.
Mm.
Or he's seen a cat or something, he'll give himself away.
Yes. You know? Now, I know you were saying that you've had some adventures or experiences on your travels with Wallace.
Yeah, just, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I've had silly situations where I've asked directions and people have actually knelt on the floor and whispered them in the dog's ear, you know, and that's true, you know. I've had situations where I've been waiting at a train station. Two trains have come, but they use the same line and they use the same platform, so I need to know which train is which, so I'm not getting on the wrong train. And people, "Oh, can't the dog tell you?" Oh yeah, it's got a woof for once for Southport and two for Oldskirk. Yes. Yeah.
Having read what
absolutely.
It says.
Oh yeah, people think they're, you know, unbelievable. You know, people think, but he's quiet, but he is a character in his own right. He's a bit of a Houdini, given the chore he is. I mean, if I was to leave that front door open now, he'd be out like a shot, wandering down the street. Having his own adventures, wandering around, you know, and God knows when he'd come back. You know, he's one of that. He is a character. He really is. He'll get his blanket and leave it anywhere in the house, folded in two, always folded in two. But now he does it, but he does always folded in two.
Oh. And you look such a little angel.
Oh, he has his moments. He has his. And people think the guide dogs are on duty 24 hours a day, and they're not.
Mm.
You know, they're when they're not working, they're just like normal dogs. They like to run in the park, or in his case, he likes to run on the beach. He likes to bound with other dogs, he likes to play with other dogs and be fussed by people. And, you know, people think they're on duty 24 hours a day, but they're not, they're really not.
Yeah.
It's just a sort of small part of their life, you know. It's a big part, but, you know, they're not constantly on duty.
Yeah. And are there, is there extra care that you have to take of a guide dog that you wouldn't necessarily do with an ordinary pet?
I think you have to be more aware of what's going on. I don't know about yourself being lab owners, but I think people think he must be. I think people think these guide dogs are starved and they never get fed. Mm. You know, so people try to sort of feed them on the sly, which really is not really helpful.
No.
Because they're on a strictly balanced diet, which is very carefully monitored.
Yeah.
And guide dogs are really strict on the dogs not being overweight in any way, because if they're overweight in any way, you know, it affects their hips, their joints. Yeah. They can't work the same way. You know, they need to be fit.
Mm-hmm.
And people think, you know, that by not giving the dog chocolate and things like that, that you're being unkind, you know, but chocolate is very bad for dogs.
Yeah.
People think that, you know, we must have crisps or we must have this hamburger or sausage or whatever. I just wish people would not distract, you know. It doesn't help, you know. And they encourage you to groom your dog every day, and that's a way of me being able to feel for any lumps and bumps that shouldn't be there, you know. So in that way I can monitor for lumps and bumps and sores and cuts, if he's, you know, got cuts on his paws. So, yeah, and that's... and they have automatic vet checkups twice a year, where they're wormed, they're vaccinated, that their anal glands are, you know, are checked and things like that. And I mean, if you notice anything wrong, or, you know, you obviously... straight to the vet,
yes.
You go, you know. And all veterinary care for a working guide dog is, you know, guide dogs pay for that, as they pay for the feed and allowance, although they do ask you to give a small donation for that, if you can, you know.
Yeah. Gosh, they put an enormous amount of people and financial resources, don't they, guide dogs? I didn't realise that it was so... You know, they must need an immense amount of fundraising for
them. Oh, they're fundraising all the time. I mean, they tell me that just to maintain one person and a dog, you know, through that dog's working lifetime and beyond, if you choose to keep your dog when they retire as a guide dog, it costs $32,000 each.
Great.
So if you... think that there are, I think there are about 4,000 or 5,000 working guide dogs out in this country. It's one hell of a lot of capital that they need. And not only that, I mean, they need to, you know, train money for the instructors. They need to maintain the breeding centre at Tollgate, which is where all the pups are born. You know, and they need to make sure that there's enough funds to support every guide dog owner, i.e. providing for the vet care and the food and everything else. So yeah, it's a huge amount.
Obviously, it's very important that the Guide Dog Association keep on doing that good work, and it's immensely important for people to support them in that work.
Absolutely.
In sort of on that note, could you put into words what Wallace means to you?
I can't do it adequately enough. When I go out with a long cane, and I can use a long cane, you know, when I don't have it, I walk a lot slower. I feel a lot more encumbered. I feel clumsy. Although I am a competent long cane user, I have to be. Because if he's ill, how do I get out?
Yeah.
You know. When you're working with a dog, there's nothing like the sense of freedom and the sense of not being impaired, you know, I don't feel blind when I'm working with him. I don't feel encumbered. I can move freely and I can move with confidence.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got my first guide dog, before I got my first guide dog, I couldn't travel independently at all. No. I couldn't go anywhere on my own. When I got Gail, all that changed. I became a different person. I became more confident. I became much more outgoing. I had a lot more sense of my own worth as an individual. And that's all thanks to the absolutely fantastic work that the Guide Dog Association are doing. And I just think it's a lovely partnership. It's a unique partnership. It's just really, really special, you know. I can't really put it into words. I can't really portray it, really.
I know what my own dog means to me, you know, and that just how much a dog can enrich people's lives. It just amazes me again and again and again, and how much they touch your heart and they're one of the family and how much they mean to you. But obviously with this relationship, that must be magnified.
Oh, it's very intense.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great relationship, you know, because you are dependent on the dog and that dog is dependent on you. So it's like a two-way, very much a two-way process, you know. And the sad thing is, to me anyway, that Wallace doesn't realise how much he does for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to him, it's normal to have his harness on. It's normal to guide.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a natural thing to ask a dog to do what he does, but to him it's as natural as breathing, you know. He loves it, and he if I don't work him for a few days, he gets restless, he gets bored, you know. He loves to be out, he loves working. But he's just a great dog. He's such good company. He's just wonderful, you know. He's just a good lad, you know. He's great fun, and we have play and we have our mad time and we have our serious time too, but you've got to strike a happy balance.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah. He's a lovely dog, because when we came in, he, you know, he gave us a lovely welcome, and a lovely Labrador welcome, you know. Very friendly, but not, as you say, he's quite a gentle.
Very, very gentle. Yeah.
But he's lovely. How old is a guide dog? Or does it vary? I mean, when do they finish their working life?
Well, it does vary. My first guide dog, she became traffic shy at 8. And what that meant, you know, like any noisy lorries or noisy buses, when she heard them, she would literally jump.
Oh.
She couldn't stand, you know, the loud noises. As she got older, she used to shake. She's got very, very traffic shy.
Mm.
So she retired when she was 8. Now, that's quite young.
Mm.
My next dog, who's a cheeky black Labrador called Mabs, she retired when she was 10.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a sort of normal average retirement age. Some dogs retire at 11, some retire at 12, but it depends how much workload, you know. If they've got a light workload, they can probably work a lot longer. If they've got quite a heavy workload, then, you know, they retire at 10, 11, that's sort of normal. You know, and then when they retire, you can do one of two things. You can keep them as a pet, and you can either work another guide dog in conjunction, you know, with looking after your old dog, which is what I did with Wallace and Mabs. So I was looking after two dogs at one point. There's a very long, and I mean long, waiting list of people who are very, very eager to look after a retired guide dog or a little puppy that doesn't quite make it as a guide dog, you know, until the end of its days. They're willing to give a home to that guide dog and look after it, you know, as a pet.
Yeah.
So it's up to you whether you keep that dog or you, if you can't keep it, if you're working all day and you're not in with your old dog all day, you know, then it's kinder to take the sad course of rehoming your old dog, which is a which is, a heart-rending thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I imagine it's a huge...
I've been lucky, I've never done it.
Yeah.
I've always managed to look after my retired dogs as well as go for a new dog.
Yeah.
Because I feel that they looked after me.
Yeah.
For their working life, it's my turn to return the favour and look after them, in their old age. And,
yeah.
But, people, it's up to the individual, whether they choose to do that or whether they want another dog and can't keep the older one,
I suppose the thing is, if you do rehome the dog, obviously you're giving somebody else the chance, as you say, to have a fantastic, really well socialised and behaved dog to enjoy.
Oh, yeah, it's there's a huge list of people who are... who would take a retired guide dog off your hands tomorrow, again, whoever they go with, they're vetted.
Mm.
They're assessed, they're interviewed. You don't apply for a dog, oh yes, here we are, it's all very much vetted and make sure that people can look after a dog properly,
Yeah.
Make sure there's always going to be somebody with the dog every day, because again, it's not like an old relationship where you might be out working all day and you may leave the dog in the yard or you may leave the dog in a kennel.
Mm.
Or these dogs aren't like, they're not used to being left all day on their own. That there's always someone with them.
Mm.
Because you're with them 24 hours a day. And they say that if you are going to leave the dog, if you leave them in the house for a maximum of about 4 or 5 hours and no more.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like a normal relationship where you may leave your pet dog all day,
Mm.
So there really needs to be someone with the dog all day or somebody who can monitor that dog all day,
I think the other thing is, yes, you can support the... Guide Dog Association by, there's puppy walking, or as you say, there's a long list of people that, eager to take the dogs on when they've retired. But, I mean, there's other ways, shorter term ways. For example, we met some people that were not exactly fostering, but just caring for a dog while the owner was in the hospital actually having a cesarean, and things like this. So there's shorter term ways that you can help support as well, aren't there?
Yeah, and those people who you're talking about are called boarders.
Mm.
And anyone can apply to be a boarder, whether a short-term or long-term. Again, they're assessed for suitability all the time. And, if I went on holiday and couldn't take him or... was going to a party or a disco and it wasn't appropriate to take him, or was going away for a short weekend, then I would ring guide dogs up and say, can you find me somebody to look after him for a couple of days, and they will try their best to do that,
Yeah. It's marvellous, the support that they give you, and you say it doesn't stop just when you get the dog, does
it? Oh, no, I mean, if I have any problems at all, all I've got to do is ring them up and they'll come out. Well, they'll get back to me over the phone and advise me what to do. For instance, when I first got him, I literally thought I was going to have to send him back.
Hmm.
Because I noticed for a couple of months he was absolutely petrified on a bus. He was shaking, he wasn't happy, he couldn't settle on a bus.
Hmm.
Now, I do quite a lot of bus travel.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, am I being cruel to him? Keeping him, expecting him to cope with long bus journeys on busy buses, So I was at my wit's end and I called them up and I said, look, I don't know what to do here. So the instructor came out and she did some work with him, and what she used to get me to do was go on a bus with a piece of cheese or a chew stick or a biscuit or something, and make it so it was almost like a game to him, so that he associated the bus with a treat.
Mm.
And so I give him lumps of cheese and pat him and talk to him, and he'd calm down and he'd stop shaking until it got that way where she said to me, okay, go on a bus, but don't give him any treats at all. Mm. See what he does. But praise him and make a fuss. You know. Until such time that got sufficient. He didn't look for the treats. He didn't, and he was calm on the buses. So that's how they coped with that particular problem. So any problems that arise, you know, they always try and find a solution, and they're always there to give support, you know, as best they can. You know, that they're a fantastic organisation, they really are.
I think you'll agree that guide dogs are remarkable, and the service they provide to their owners is invaluable. It really is well worth supporting this work in any way you can. There are links on the Dogcast site to the Guide Dog Association in the UK and others around the world. If you'd like to know more, there's also a link to an article by Robin Kettle about guide dog facts, including how to behave around a guide dog, what to do, and just as importantly, what not to do. I recently met two people who expressed views about guide dogs that surprised me, particularly after a meeting with Julie Rodway and her guide dog Wallace, and all we learned from them. These opinions jarred. The first was a man who was now the proud owner of a failed guide dog. This young Labrador was as full of the joys of life as any young Labrador is. He came and met our dogs, ran away, then later came back and met us. It turns out he had not made the grade as a guide dog because he was not outgoing enough. His new owner said that being a guide dog was no life for a dog anyway. The second was a man I met while walking our dogs. He himself was partially sighted, and when we fell into conversation, he told me that people had advised him to get a guide dog, but he thought it was too much to ask of a dog, and that he didn't think you could look after a dog properly if you couldn't see. I was completely taken aback by both these exchanges, and it set me thinking about attitudes to these marvellous dogs. I think the thing here is that people are confused about what a dog wants from life, and also they suffer from projecting human values onto dogs, which always leads to trouble. Dogs are not humans, and while we may think it's a wonderful life to sit around watching TV all day, dogs disagree. They need activity. They thrive on having a purpose. They love to please, and they want to serve. You only have to witness the enthusiastic wagging of a guide dog's tail as his harness goes on to know how much they enjoy what they do. It's not a burden to them, but a joy. Consider the lifestyle of a guide dog. They have an owner who is with them virtually 24/7. The advice given to owners is to leave the dogs for no more than 4 to 5 hours. Constant companionship. That rates high on a dog's happiness scale. More than mere company, though, these dogs have an owner who interacts meaningfully with them for the majority of the day. Daily grooming is part of a guide dog's routine. Again, something enjoyable that strengthens the bond between dog and handler. Does your dog enjoy outings? I know how much mine does, how he leaps and bounds to the door when he knows he's coming with me, and how he hangs back, waiting for the consolation of treats or a Kong, when the sad realisation hits him that I intend to leave him behind. Compare that to a guide dog. His accompanying his owner is almost guaranteed every single time. Not for him, the nose pressed against the window as he watches his people disappear. Guide dogs do have off-duty time. They do get to play, and they do get to run free. They are highly trained, but correctly done reward-based training is not by any standards cruel. The natural abilities of these dogs is simply channeled. They have a purpose, and they are loved and valued beyond words. Right from birth, guide dogs are fortunate. Those bred for the purpose are produced from carefully considered matings, while those donated or bought have to meet health and temperament criteria. This means they have the best chance of being a well-balanced, happy, healthy dog, and that any guide dog you meet is far less likely to have mental or physical problems than any pet dog you encounter. Add to this the fact that daily checks while grooming and guaranteed medical attention means that guide dogs are some of the best cared for dogs around. Any dogs that fail at any stage of the training process, and those that have to be rehomed for their retirement, are found homes with people who have been carefully checked to make sure they will give the dog a good home. So the next time you meet a guide dog, don't pity him. He has a wonderful life. Save your sympathy for the countless pet dogs around the world who receive inadequate exercise, lack mental stimulation, and are left to their own devices for hours on end. For it is them, and not guide dogs, that deserve it. To round off today's programme, here's a recording Julie Rodaway made out and about with Wallace.
I'm stood outside my house. Wallace has got his harness on. It's not a bad day outside, and I've just got my foot in the right position to instruct him to go forward. So I'm just going to lift the harness handle on his back, and off we go. Forward. Good boy. And what he's doing now is he's walking straight, and as I say, not today, good boy. He thinks that I want to go to the bus stop, which is just across the road. While I'm walking, I'd like to point out, if I may, that it's vitally important not to distract a dog when it's working. Please don't call it, don't distract it. Good lad! What he's doing now is weaving me in and out of things now. And I'm actually walking down a busy road now. And we're going to cross it in a moment. Also, while I'm walking, can I also point out, good lad, straight on, that if you see a guide dog with a harness handle on its back and the person stood, that means assistance is needed. Hop up to the curb. Good boy. Right up to the curb. Good boy. Forward. Good boy. Just crossing the road now. Straight to the curb. Good boy. Hop, hop. What he's done there is put his two front steps on the curb to indicate that we were coming to the up curb. And we're just continuing on our way. Yes, so if you see a guide dog with its harness on its back, that does mean assistance is needed. If you hear rattling, because I've got shopping in my right hand as we're walking along. For Dogcast Radio, this is Julian Wallace, signing over and out.
Till next time, look after yourselves and your dogs.
Thanks for listening to Dogcast Radio, available from www.dogcastradio.com. That's dogcastradio.com. If you'd like to get in touch with us, and wherever you are in the world, we'd love to hear from you. You can do so in a variety of ways. By phone from the UK, you can contact us on 0121-288-0922. From the US, you can contact us on our American number, which is 315-849-2022. From any other country, you'll need your international exit code and then 44121-288-0922. You can contact us on Skype with the ident Dogcast Radio. That's all one word, Dogcast Radio. By email, you can contact me on julie@dogcastradio.com. When contacting us by email, if you have the facilities, please record your questions or comments and send them to us as an audio file. That way we can include them directly in our programme. We can accept most formats, for example, WAV, MP3. All these methods of contacting us can be found on our website, which is www.dogcastradio.com. And as ever, the final word goes to Jenny.
What do you get if you cross a giraffe and a dog? An animal that barks at low-flying aircraft.